As you know, beloved listeners, we are seeking a new theme because we've run out of the rights to play Elena Katz-Chernin, and suggestions, bizarre, baroque, eccentric, are rushing in. But that's delightful. I played a snatch of it last week at the end of the program, but it's called Dripping Tap Blues. And the mouth organ is Betwixt the Lips of Rex Honey Boy Hill, who was the original harmonica player with the Backsliders, a group of considerable merit. Thanks, Rex. That was charming, and we shall see what the listeners make of it. It's the year of the monkey, and Jeremy Barmé will be rejoining the program after a bit of an absence to tell us of the significance of these monkey years in Chinese politics, and you will be astonished by the events the monkey seems to have triggered. And then we're going to have a chat with Miranda Stewart about matters of taxation. As you've just heard in the news, Angela Merkel's currently in Turkey debating refugee matters. The Turks have been quite extraordinary in allowing so many Syrian Kurdish refugees to cross the border. All up, a couple of million. And whilst you'd think that would get nothing but applause, it is seen as problematic in Europe. But let's look at it from another angle. Later this year, the doors will open to the newest and largest mosque ever built in Turkey. Six rocket-like minarets and a giant dome of this new colossus in Istanbul is in many ways symbolic of the rising power and wealth of the leader of Turkey and its towering leader, President Erdogan, who we've much discussed in previous programs. He began political life as mayor of Istanbul in 1994, then moved on to become prime minister 9 years later, president from 2014. Economic growth under his watch has seen the living standards of Turks improved by most measures, and it continues, yes, to be that welcoming haven to refugees. Its position in the region unique, and much depends on how it manages to handle many a complex issue. Max Rodenbeck is South Asia Bureau Chief with The Economist. He spent quite a few years in Cairo, then Turkey, now based in New Delhi, and I welcome to our little wireless program. Max, Turkey has become the geopolitical hotspot, straddling its location in the region, its culture, but it does appear to be doing at least a pretty good job in handling the refugees from Syria.
Well, yes, thank you, Philip. Yeah, in many ways it has. It's been incredibly generous. I mean, Turkey's taken in at least 2 million Syrian refugees of all stripes, more than any other country. And at this stage, a lot of them have now passed through Turkey and gone on to Europe. But just as we speak, you know, there's a new wave poised to rush into Turkey with all of these very recent refugees from the city of Aleppo, which is being pounded by the Russian Air Force just now. So there's something like 35,000 people who've just washed up on the Turkish border waiting to cross.
Okay, so the Europeans have offered aid for Turkey in accepting the refugees. But let us remember that Turkey is still not a member of the EU. How do they feel about that?
Well, it makes everyone feel a little bit uncomfortable that there's a sort of bargain of European money for Turkish control on refugees. I mean, it isn't a very savory bargain. But the Europeans don't know what to do about this flow of refugees. And the Turks, it makes sense to recompense them for what they've spent themselves. Turkey itself has
Where you're cutting out, sorry to interrupt, but you're cutting out rather badly. I wonder whether we can call back. Yes, we will. So I'll talk to you again in a minute, Max, once we've got a better connection. Yes, the theme. I'm having a lot of fun with these themes. We've had some bizarre suggestions and recommendations, but keep sending them in, won't you, because time is running out with Elena. And we've simply got to find something that will carry us proudly through 2016 and into whatever future lies ahead. as I said a little later in the program, Jeremy Barmer, who's one of my all-time favourite guests, a wonderful sinologist, will be joining us on the Year of the Monkey. And we'll also be discussing tax reform. What's wrong with our tax system? Essentially, it's bloody complicated. And we all, I think, have rights to complain about the way the big spenders get away without paying much, if any. And that doesn't seem right, does it? Then there's all the problems and complexities of the GST. As you can hear, I'm treading water desperately while awaiting a facial expression from my colleagues, but we're still having problems. Okay, he's back. Max, can you say something to me to give me confidence?
Yeah, I'm back on the scratchy Skype connection.
Okay, well, that's much better. Now, Turkey's strategic position, very sensitive. You describe Erdogan as having been slow in recognising the danger of his own policies in the region, his tolerance of the radicals who oppose Assad of Syria. Still holding fast to that?
Well, I think things have changed on the ground that have forced the Turkey to change its position, along with a lot of other people. I mean, basically, with Russia's entry into the Syrian war, with its sort of with its full air force and so on, it's actually changed the equation in the Syrian civil war, and the Islamist groups that Turkey had been backing have now been.
I think that's Erdogan on the phone. Do you want to take it? He never makes a big decision without talking to you.
Absolutely never. No.
Isn't live radio a wonderful medium? Press on.
Right. Yeah. Charge on. So things have changed on the ground in Syria, and so Turkey's had to change its policy. I mean, it's just had to readjust, and they're no longer so thrilled about letting arms flow through to all of these Islamist groups, and particularly got stung by Islamic State, which Turkey had been never friendly with, but they had just had a policy of letting whoever wanted to go into Syria go in. But in the last year, there have been several terrorist attacks in Turkey by Islamic State, and because of that, Turkey has closed its border with Syria and got much more concerned about the whole situation.
Now, Max, Turkey's directly stoked the ire of Russia by opposing Assad and then by downing a Russian jet when it crossed into its airspace within Syria. Do you expect more clashes between Turkey and Russia?
Well, the Russians have really thrown down the gauntlet. I mean, Turkey is a smaller country, and they've had 200 years of animosity between them. There's a long enmity that goes back a very long way. But Russia is the stronger of the two, and I think it's kind of outmaneuvered Turkey as well in the Syrian conflict by simply, you know, moving in with its full armed force and sort of took Turkey by surprise. Then there was this incident when the Turks shot down a Russian plane, and Turkey was sort of putting down a marker, like, don't push us too far. But the Russians' response has been so ferocious that the Turks have sort of backed off to a certain extent. So
I understand the Russians responded with a suite of sanctions, which are trimming quite a lot from the Turkish GDP.
That's right. They slapped a bunch of sanctions on and a lot of harumphing, but they also physically started bombing all kinds of things in Syria, very close, right up to the Turkish frontier, and specifically bombing a lot of the groups that Turkey had been backing. So, it sends a very strong message. Just don't mess with us.
Could Russia also turn off the pipeline because Turkey imports most of its gas from Russia?
That's true. The Russians could do that, but they probably won't because it sends a terrible signal to all of their other customers. I mean, plenty of Russia's supplying gas to most of Europe as well. And whenever the Russians try to use their gas diplomacy in a rather undiplomatic way, it sends shivers through the whole market and just makes people look for gas from other sources. So it's actually not very good for Russia, really.
Now, depending on who you ask, and I've asked a variety of people on the program, Erdogan is perceived as either cunning or ambitious or a saviour of the people. Or perhaps he's a combination of all of those things.
Well, yes, I guess he is, but it sort of depends who you talk to. I mean, what's really striking in Turkey right now is how polarized the country is. I mean, Erdogan, his party just won an election with about 50% of the vote, and he has very strong support from, you know, really literally 50% of the public. But the other 50%, a lot of them are very bitterly opposed to him and think he's far too ambitious and that his party has shut down freedoms in ways that are extremely disturbing.
Now, his AK party, I believe, translates as justice and development.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So he's given some development, but perhaps not a lot of justice.
Well, he's given a bit of justice, too. They've been in power now for more than 12 years, so the first half of that was pretty good on both scores. They gave both justice and development. But the second half, the justice and development is sort of turning more into vengeance against their critics and cronyism for their friends.
But as you pointed out, he had a majority win in the last year's election, but it's not enough for him. He wants to fiddle with the constitution. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, for reasons known best to Mr. Erdogan, he wants to change the constitution to give himself more powers. His current position is as president, and normally in Turkey, the president has not been a particularly powerful position. It's a sort of figurehead position. But because Erdogan has been such a powerful force in his ruling party, from its inception until now, he really does dominate the political scene, even though he theoretically, constitutionally, doesn't have powers. What he's saying now is that he wants more constitutional powers and to change the whole system into a presidential rather than a parliamentary system.
Now, it's a unicameral house, isn't it? Just doesn't have an upper house.
That's right. Yeah, it's just one house.
Okay. Would he have a lot more power if he succeeds in redrafting?
It's unclear exactly what he's going to ask for. I mean, he's trying to sort of put the ducks in a row to be able to ask for this. But what exactly they would describe as his presidential powers is not entirely clear. But I mean, he has plenty of power already. So what exactly he wants more? I mean, he'd be able to hire and fire all his ministers and so on. Now there's a prime minister who's a relatively weak character and, of course, is from the same political party, and Erdogan can boss him around anyway. So one thing people are saying is that Erdogan may want more powers to make himself more immune from potential prosecution for any reason.
I like the way he's got one of his son-in-law as a cabinet member, and he's anointed a former chauffeur as an MP.
That's right. Yeah. It's sort of all in the family. I mean, it's something that, you know, it's a bit sort of Shakespearean. As in the 12 years that he's been in power, a lot of his original allies who sort of brought him to power have been squeezed out of the picture. And the ones who've been brought in are the total loyalists, including members of his own family.
Now, he's a very modest fellow because he's tackling a 1,000-room presidential complex. This is reminiscent of Saddam Hussein. What's that all about?
Well, it's a very nice palace. I think he wasn't convinced that his palace was good enough.
What it had about 800 rooms, didn't it?
That's right. Yeah, a mere 800, and this one sits on a hilltop that really dominates the city. And it's got. I mean, I did visit there, and those 1,000 rooms. It didn't look like more than a few hundred of them actually were filled. The rest of them seemed to be empty.
Will it be as large or bigger than the mosque we were talking about at the head of the program?
Well, I think the mosque is probably the biggest thing of all. It's a huge, huge thing, and what's striking is how much like the, you know, Istanbul is famous for its silhouette of mosques and domes. And this one is just bigger than all the others. And of course, the old mosques and domes were built by the great Ottoman sultans. And so there's a lot of symbolic value in Erdogan building this new mosque. It makes him look like he's as powerful as one of these great rulers of the Ottoman Empire, which was, of course, for hundreds of years the world's largest empire.
Who are his friends in the region?
Well, he no longer has very many. It has to be said. When he started power, Turkey adopted a policy of no problems with it, any of its neighbors. And this was quite successful for a while, but as the Arab Spring has turned into a terrible Arab winter, and there's been violence in the region around Turkey, it's been hard to keep up these friendships. And as it is now, Turkey actually looks rather isolated.
I understand that it had a huge amount of trade in the region, and much of that has now been lost.
Well, that's true, and it's not Turkey's fault. I mean, the region itself, the Middle East, has fallen into a lot of trouble, and it had been the fastest growing place for exports. And Turkish exports have been a big success story. The country does trade a lot, so it has been a blow just to see countries like Syria and Iraq reduced to rubble.
Thinking back over the history of Turkey, which you've been touching on, we have to acknowledge that for a long time most Turks have been pretty moderate in their attitude towards Islam. They distinguished quite clearly between Turkish and Arab Islam.
That's quite right. Yeah. Islam as practiced in Turkey has generally been very, very mild and moderate, and dominated by Sufi lodges, spiritualism, and so on. There's a kind of barrier because the Turks speak Turkish and not Arabic, but the Quran is in Arabic. There's a sort of buffer between the average citizen, the average Muslim in Turkey, and the actual religious text. So whereas in the Arab world, an average Arab person thinks that they understand the Quran themselves, in Turkey there's a sort of recognition that, no, I don't really understand it. I have to ask someone what it really means.
But you've written that a lot of his support comes from Turkey's Quran Belt in central Anatolia, where they have a sort of a cult-like devotion to this former food vendor.
Well, that's very true, but you have to go back into Turkish history. I mean, the key thing that happened in Turkey last century was the rise of Kemal Atatürk, who was this great secularizing dictator, basically, who wrenched Turkey out of its old Ottoman ways and dragged it into much more sort of modern ways, including eliminating the old Arabic script and putting in European script and banning all kinds of religious practices and so on. He sort of frog marched Turkey into secularism. And needless to say, there was always a large chunk of the Turkish public that wasn't happy with that. But they were sort of crushed and couldn't speak when the military was in charge. So when Erdogan and his party took over, they have been the voice for this long silent religious constituency.
And yet now Turkey is extending its reach beyond its borders. It's built over 100 mosques and schools in 25 countries. In Gaza, it's rebuilding mosques destroyed by Israel.
That's right. But actually, as I, speaking to officials from Turkey's sort of religious establishment, which is entirely controlled by the state, interestingly enough, although it was supposedly a secular state, it has there's state-controlled mosques. One of the reasons they're doing this is that they want to promote a more moderate form of Islam. They say that, that countries like Saudi Arabia have been giving lots of money all around the world to promote a rather radical and dry fundamentalist kind of Islam, and the Turks would like to promote a different kind.
Max, thanks for your time. That was fascinating. Max Rodenbeck, South Asia Bureau Chief with The Economist magazine. And this is Len Nell on RN, and now I'm going to sort out your tax problems. Beloved listeners, we're all being heavily taxed by the countless articles on tax from the Commentariat, drumming into our heads at the moment for reform is nigh, and if we don't seize it, we'll burn in hell forevermore. Of course, similar things were said about the budget surplus. Depending on who is talking, we've heard that taxes are too high, too low, targeting the wrong people, that they're the only way to get us out of the hole left over from the diminishing resources boom, that raising the GST is our only hope, and that we're heading for economic disaster by even thinking of raising the damn thing. Bafflement. Well, we're all baffled. With me now on the blower is Professor Miranda Stewart. Miranda is director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. She's just flown back into the country after being in highly taxed Europe. Confesses to jet lag, but nonetheless, I'm sure she's going to clear up the whole tax mess for us. Miranda, before we get into it, though, the Crawford School. Who was Crawford?
You know, there was a J.G. Crawford. He was you're testing me here. He was a senior bureaucrat who had a strong engagement in public policy in the relatively early days.
I'm sorry to trip you up, but I always ask guests for who the hell was the named chair. You failed the test.
I've completely failed the test, and I'll be prepared next time.
Okay, I'll ask you next time, and you'll be word perfect.
That's right.
Now, Miranda, apart from the fact that corporations and high earners get away with paying little tax or no tax on the grounds that they must be encouraged, what's wrong with our tax system?
Well, when you put it that way, there's not that much wrong with it when you think of the system as a whole. And that might be one of the reasons why we're in such a confusing policy debate at the moment. As you say, so many different perspectives being brought to the problem is because while lots of people can see ways to improve the system, and no doubt there are many ways we could improve the system, it's not about to collapse, in my opinion, and it's not in crisis.
I'm deeply shocked that you're not shocked. I mean, I can't cope with this. Heavens above. Well, look, let me put it another way. How does our tax system, with all its complications and complexities, that's the same thing, that's a tautology, how does our tax system compare with other countries' tax systems, with the US, for example, or with the European countries?
So comparisons are a tricky beast. If you compare at the level of the overall tax take, if you like, the share of government in the economy, we're sort of in the moderate to low end of what you might call rich countries, around about between 25% and 30% of GDP altogether. We're more like the US than we are like France or Sweden, for example. If you think about the kinds of taxes, we have a very strong reliance on a personal income tax, and that goes back more than 100 years. You'd have to say it's a very successful tax in our country. We seem to like the progressive rates and the fairness, and we have somewhat less reliance on consumption taxes, indirect taxes including the GST, than many other countries in Europe, for example.
When I say GST, do you cross yourself and, can you cope?
Look, the GST is an essential part of the tax mix, but it's a very political, highly visible tax that is not perfect and has its own weaknesses like any tax does. And so attempts saying that we might just increase the GST and that would solve all our problems is actually a very big ask. I think the public quite rightly wants to know, you're going to tax me more, what are we getting for it?
Of a sudden, Paul Keating has come out of, briefly, yet again, out of retirement, and to suggest that an increase in the GST, for which he was, as you well know, an enthusiastic advocate, would be simply giving billions of extra money to a government or to governments that are not competent to spend it.
Well, see, there you end up in a debate that's not just about tax anymore. It's about what we spend it on. That's exactly the point. And this one of the big issues in this ongoing debate has been, are we taxed too much or too little? Are we spending too much or too little? And I think we haven't yet resolved that question. And so it makes tax reform very difficult. Are you increasing it or decreasing it for a start?
Well, the states all seem to be on the same page. They want more GST and more of the GST that is raised.
Well, the state's role in our fiscal federalist structure, I guess, is to spend money. I mean, you know, and they regulate as well, but really they are the core spending agencies of our government. The federal government does spend a lot of money, but about a third of that is just cash in, cash out, the transfers, what you might think of as the social security or welfare system. But the state governments actually spend money on health, education, crime, justice, roads, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they see is the big pressure on the spending side. And not surprisingly, they would like a reasonably effective tax, which the GST is, to give them more revenue under their control to deal with that spending.
I oppose an increase to 15% for the simple reason that I can just work out 10% when I'm toting things up, and I've got no hope with 15. Why is 15 the magic number? Why could we not split the difference?
Well, in fact, I personally, and not that my view is more merit than anybody else's, I would be in favour of 12.5 myself. There is room to increase it in the sense of in our overall tax mix, we've actually gone backwards in the extent to which we tax consumption, including using customs, excise, other indirect taxes, tobacco taxes, as well as the GST. We tax consumption less than we did 20 years ago. And so, or, you know, less than we did. We introduced the GST and that brought us back up to a level, and that has fallen off again. So there's an argument for increasing taxing consumption, and we might as well use the GST to do that.
As you know, I'm a fiscal dimwit, but it does seem to me that companies or high earners will be forced to pay additional tax that they can't just fudge the books.
Look, high-income earners, high individual income earners, you have to be a little careful. So wage earners are paying pretty high fraction of tax at the high end, high wage earners that are just, you know, doing well in the wage system. Those who have businesses or capital investment tend to be able to cap their rate overall at sort of around about 30%. But they actually pay quite a lot of tax, individuals, as long as we catch them and don't allow them to shelter income offshore. We could have high individual income earners pay a bit more income tax by closing off some of those very attractive low tax havens in our own system, and that's the super tax regime and things like negative gearing, which high income earners benefit the most from.
I remember 20 years ago we did a lot of programs on the Tobin tax, so-called, the idea of micro taxes on this enormous amount of international money movement. Is that ever discussed?
It is, and this idea of so Piketty's work and Zucman in the US, this recent work is new attention to wealth and financial transactions taxes. It kind of builds on the Tobin tax model. None of it has actually been enacted anywhere yet. In Europe, there's about 11 countries that had in principle agreed to enact a financial transactions tax, but they haven't yet gone ahead. So it does raise a lot of challenges politically across borders because, of course, any jurisdiction could just try to opt out.
I think it's absolutely outrageous to suggest that multinationals like Google or Apple pay tax, and you know, I'm totally opposed to the suggestions of Shorten and Bowen that cracking down on these companies is better than increasing GST, he said, with a heavy attempt.
Are you really?
With yes, a heavy attempt at irony.
I see. Well, you know, there is a viable economic position out there that would agree with you, you know, so you have to be careful with the ironic.
Okay, well, I withdraw the irony and put it to you. What are the pros and cons of that argument that Shorten and Bowen are raising, that cracking down on big business is better than increasing GST?
Look, I would be in favour of more focused and careful attention to enforcement on tax on multinationals, and also reforming some of that corporate tax, those rules about profit shifting. There are things we can do there. There are global coordinated processes that are slowly moving on, and Australia can do some things unilaterally. The issue with that for me is that there is some revenue there. There might even be a few billion of revenue there. It's very hard to know. But it's not enough. So I agree with them that we need to crack down on multinationals to some degree, but it's not going to solve our ongoing issue of how we fund government. We
really Miranda, are some countries holding the big companies to account?
Oh, look, very few. I mean, Google, Starbucks, et cetera, pay very little tax around the globe. They are US companies originally, those big multinationals, most of them, and so they do pay some corporate tax in the US market. You know, they're located in the US market. It's a big market. They sell a lot of iPhones there and a lot of advertising. They do pay some US corporate tax. But elsewhere in the world, they have an extremely low effective tax rate, you know, below 5%, maybe 1% or 2%. So no country is successfully taxing them.
I'm talking to Professor Miranda Stewart, Director of Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the ANU's Crawford, whoever he was, School of Public Policy. The other night, I was talking to an investigative reporter from Bloomberg's who was giving this remarkable account of how vast numbers, trillions of dollars, are currently being taken out of tax havens all over the world and placed in a panic on the American mainland that now Reno, Nevada, for example, and South Dakota, are major centres of, you know, money that had been hidden. And the reason the plutocrats are bringing their money onshore is because there's a deadline before the government starts hammering them. Have you been watching this extraordinary development, Reno, Nevada, for God's sake, becoming a tax haven?
No, look, that's actually news to me, but there is a precedent. The US has had quite concessional rules in its international tax system for decades that have a very low tax or even an exemption on interest earned where you have foreign monies coming onshore into accounts. I forget the details, but they did that as deliberate policy in order to attract foreign capital from Latin America, and they succeeded. So essentially the US established itself as a tax haven for foreign capital of some sorts decades ago. And so what you're telling me sounds consistent with that, that those provisions are being used and regulatory financial centres are being set up in perhaps rather surprising places in the US.
I didn't mean to cut across.
No, that's
you.
Correct.
People are now asking questions, some members of the commentariat, what's the purpose of a Turnbull government if he backs off issue after issue because of political danger? He's already now being lambasted and raspberried because he's publicly walking back from a GST increase. What would be the repercussions of no reform?
Well, he's got an election this year, and you're much more experienced at political commentary and observation than I am, but my sense is that if he hands down a budget that is moderately popular, unlike the previous two budgets that we've seen, that's where his primary political focus, I would have thought, would lie, and that will lead him into an election.
He could, of course, do some minor fiddling, couldn't he? He could peel back on superannuation tax benefits for the wealthy, on negative gearing concessions. Might that be at least mildly efficacious?
He could. I mean, this sort of backing off from the GST, as I said, the GST is a very difficult tax politically, and it's not surprising to me, that he would do that. He still has within his, control, if you like. He has the personal income tax, really. And if he's interested in lowering marginal tax rates for some workers, that might be popular. He can potentially fund that by broadening the base. And he can broaden the base by reducing super concessions, reducing negative gearing, perhaps coming up with some proposals about work deductions, although that can be pretty politically controversial too. So it would be will be interesting to see if he does come up with some things there, which would not be a bad reform to do some fixing of the personal income tax.
Miranda, thanks for your time. Professor Miranda Stewart, Director of Director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the ANU, and this is LNL on RN. And next up, we're going to talk about China's New Year, and you will hear a very beautiful poem written by that wonderful, wonderful writer, Mao Zedong. as if you didn't already know, beloved listener, Feb 8 marks the start of the Chinese year of the Golden Monkey. And the figure of the fictional Monkey King, Sun Wukong, is a very important one in Chinese history, as you are about to learn. This year marks 50, since Mao Zedong famously said, "I possess some of the spirit of the tiger and some of the monkey." And looking back over the past, it's clear that Mao's very disruptive monkey came to overshadow the tiger spirit and that of his countrymen. I'm joined now from New Zealand by my favourite sinologist, historian, cultural critic, filmmaker and founder of the Australian Centre on China in the World, Jeremy Barmé. And I've turned to Jeremy over the decades to guide my tottering footsteps on matters Chinese. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thank you, Philip. Delightful to be here.
Do Chinese make all sorts of new resolutions like we do?
No, there's many hopes for great things to happen in the new year. Usually there are pledges by people for other people to make money, or wishes for money and good fortune. And this is, you know, a recent reinvention of the Chinese New Year since the Cultural Revolution. In the past, in China, in the Cultural Revolution era and before, you would have a revolutionized New Year in which you would pledge yourself to the state and service of the revolution.
Do you have access to that extraordinary poem that Mao wrote about the Golden Monkey, which begins, "A thunderstorm burst over the earth"?
Indeed. Now, this is a poem that he wrote actually for a photograph made by the budding photographic artistic talent Li Jin, who happened to be his wife, Jiang Qing. So he inscribed this poem on the back of a photograph of an opera performance that he saw in 1961. And the poem read, and it's about the Soviet Union. About the Soviet Union and revisionism and political troubles. And the poem reads, "A thunderstorm burst over the earth. A devil rose from a heap of white bones. The deluded monk was not beyond the light, but the malignant demon must wreak havoc. The golden monkey, Sun Wukong, wrathfully swung his massive cudgel, and the jade-like firmament was cleared of dust. Today, a miasma mist once more is rising, and we hail the Sun Wukong, the wonder worker."
Pretty good stuff, isn't it? It's got a nice rhythm to it.
They said the comments from people like Pierre Rickman, Simon Lay, my teacher, were that his Mao's poetry and calligraphy were a bit better than Hitler's painting, but not as good as Churchill's.
Okay. But now let's get stuck into what has tended to happen in these years. Can you just take us through a sequence of them?
Well, this year is a monkey year. It's the 1980, the first time they celebrated these New Years, these traditional Chinese New Years, in a traditional way after the Cultural Revolution, was a monkey year. It was the first year that they issued a New Year's stamp in the People's Republic. But this year is significant not just because of the monkey and both the malign and delightful influences of monkeys in the past. It's also a year pregnant with reminiscence and memory in China. And I'll just run through a few of them. It was in 1916, which is 100 years ago, that the last empire was declared by the then president of the Republic of China, Yuan Shikai. He died a few years later, but he did leave China a palace called the China Palace, which is now the seat of government of the People's Republic of China. In 1926, the KMT launched its northern expedition, which unified the country and began the split with the Communist Party, which in 1936 led to the Long March and the peaceful conclusion of the Long March, China's unsuccessful participation in the Berlin Olympics. 1946 saw the end of the war with Japan and the beginning of China's civil war, which continues to this day, so very important. 1956 was the great 100 Flowers movement, where people were encouraged to speak out and help the party correct its mistakes. They spoke out so loudly and so consistently that Mao had them all crushed and sent off 300,000 of them to labor reform in the northeast of China. 1966, 10 years later, saw the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution. The Red Guards themselves, calling themselves Little Monkey Kings, they brought chaos to all under heaven, taking their lead from Chairman Mao. 76, 10 years later, saw the death of Mao and the detention and then trial and jailing of the so-called Gang of Four, including Jiang Qing, she who made the photograph in 1961. 1986 was China's first explosion of popular protest in favor of media freedom and constitutional government, which led to the fall of Party General Secretary Hu Yaobang and the events of 89, major monumental thing. 1996, only 20 years ago, was again incredibly important in Chinese history because it's the first time a democratic election was held in Taiwan that saw the election of an independently selected president, the Republic of China, Li Donghui, and that's had great consequences for that island, province, nation, depending on how you want to put it. 2006, 10 years later, Australia, you'll remember, announced the 9 Australian values that were stuck up by Brendan Nelson and John Howard in schools throughout the country. China, for its part, announced the 8 do's and don'ts, the social values of China, that now form the core of what is called socialist values that oppose Western values and liberal ideas in the West. And that has now become a central element of Xi Jinping's rule. And this year will be a year pregnant with commemoration and silences.
Now, you're listening to Jeremy Barmé, who, as I said, is a formidable sinologist, historian, cultural critic, filmmaker, and founder of the Australian Centre on China in the World. Okay, let's go back to one of these interesting years, 56, the Hundred Flowers Movement, when intellectuals were enticed out of their holes, quote-unquote, to critique the Communist Party. Have the Chinese yet got over this nationwide purge of expression?
Sadly, they haven't. And we should have to preface it by saying, in 1946, with the outbreak of this attempted conciliation between the KMT and the communists and a possible new civil government that leads to civil war, but 46 to 49, these 3 years of chaos, the communists promise repeatedly, and there's a volume of all the speeches, statements, and announcements by Mao and all the others, we will bring China a democracy. One man, one vote. There will be free media. There will be respect for human rights. There will be no arbitrary punishment, arbitrary arrests or jailings. We will change China thoroughly. So people supported the Communist Party on the basis of all of those promises. 1956, the people are encouraged to speak out to help the Communist Party realize its aims. And a lot of people, thousands, tens of thousands, say, wait a second, you all promised this, that, and the other. We want that now. And then Mao said, my God, this is getting out of control. It's going to be like the Hungarian Petőfi Club incident, and there'll be a rebellion like they've had over in Eastern Europe. And so he clamps down with Deng Xiaoping as his head of the office that crushes the so-called rightist attack on the party, and this leads to this massive purge of people. 1978-79, the Communist Party, after Mao's death, abandons radical revolutionary ideology in favor of economic construction, what we know as the reform and opening up period. It's led to China's extraordinary transformation. One thing doesn't change. They say the Cultural Revolution was wrong. A lot of Mao's rule was wrong. 70% good, 30% bad. However, one thing was right. The attack on the right of stuff, the Hundred Flowers in 1956, was correct. And to prove it, they left 6 people not rehabilitated. 300,000 were rehabilitated, brought back from jail, given back all of their salaries and so on and so forth. But 6 were named as rightists by Deng Xiaoping, who said they can never be rehabilitated, for if we do, the whole system, all of it, will unravel. And so to this day, there's these 6 individuals who use as an excuse not to allow a rehabilitation of the past, but also not to allow China to move forward to become the free, independent, democratic, human rights-respecting country that was promised in the
future. Jeremy, I love that. I think it would be very interesting for you and I to sit here and get a list of 6 people on whom we can blame all Australia's troubles.
It wouldn't be fair. Well, we can name a few right now.
No, we can't. Behave yourself, Jeremy.
One could. I don't know.
One could.
I'll reduce my monkey spirit.
Okay. Now, the penchant for public confessions hasn't disappeared in China. The Economist reported that there's been a return to public confessions. There was one that you wouldn't notice by a senior financial journalist who said he was, quote, distressed at having helped create the panic and disorder in China's recent market drop. This is another form of magic, isn't it?
Well, it is indeed, but it links back to 56 and the whole Maoist and pre-Maoist era. Xi Jinping, or the man I call chairman of everything, since he has more titles than even the Qianlong emperor has, he's the chairman of 10, 12 committees, for heaven's sake. Xi Jinping has revived a lot of the elements of the Maoist era, in particular the founding era of criticism, self-criticism, let's be public about our short shortcomings to make other people confess their crimes and so on and so forth. And it's used, these confessions on television and in public are used to ritually humiliate and reinforce the party's sort of moralistic and values-driven goals. The aims are intimidation, and they work very well. What we see for the first time is in public. In the past, this happened many times. Many foreigners have been forced to confess, write confessions and self-criticisms. I've done my own fair share as a student in the 1970s. But to drag people onto TV and to blame them for things and make them confess, always obviously under duress. Not the point. It's not the point to show that they're under duress. The point is to make them do it and for everybody else to just take note.
It's their form of the McCarthyist technique, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it, of course, the whole origin of it in the 20th century comes from Christian ritual and the confession, which much influenced the development of Soviet-type public trials and confessions and accusations. So it's within this long tradition of behavior. But they've modernized it and put everybody on TV. They've got TV foreign executives, lawyers, and most recently an NGO worker from Sweden, I think. He was forced to confess on TV. It's quite chilling for international people involved with China who until now thought foreigners were inviolate in this regard, but they're not.
Decades ago, on one of my first trips to China, I met with you quietly, secretly in a hotel room, and you managed to get into that room a few young dissident artists, and they came at considerable risk to themselves. Has that situation improved to some extent?
Well, it has to an extent. Chinese art in the last 10 or 20 years has been quite a market valuable thing. And so those dissident artists are no longer much in trouble. Though, as we know, Ai Weiwei, a friend of mine from the 70s, has had his ups and downs, but still manages somehow, while being still independent and critical, to get away with things. Quite recently he's had many great exhibitions, in particular Melbourne, it's an extraordinary exhibition. But most other artists are doing relatively okay. It's other people. It's the intellectuals now. It's the human rights lawyers. It's the local activists. It's the people who try and protect civil rights. They are under pressure, and they are being gone after by the authorities in an organized and systematic way that we haven't seen before, and that's been terrifying. In the first year of Xi Jinping's rule, I remember going to Beijing and seeing very well-connected friends. They said, Xi Jinping might not have achieved very much, but he has achieved one thing. He's made everybody scared.
Mm. Okay, the Economist says that supposed public outrage is a useful tool and enables the party to put aside its principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries. Let me ask you this. Is the imp out of the bottle with social media, or can the Chinese keep that under control?
This has been a discussion I did in 1997. Wired magazine in San Francisco invited me and an oral historian, Sung Ye, to do a review of the Chinese then up-and-coming internet world. And from then on, we've seen the explosion of the internet. We've seen WeChat, Weixin, Weibo, and so on and so forth. Blogs come and go. In the last two or three years under Xi Jinping and Lu Wei, who's the man in charge of the internet world of China, they have systematically, and on the basis of old Maoist thinking and theory and attitudes about how you divide and rule and making exemplary punishments and so on and so forth, they have tamed Weibo, they have tamed WeChat, they have tamed blogs. 2 years ago, the head of the Internet Authority, Lu Wei, called in the five most famous bloggers, and then they systematically punished a few of them in public and caused, dragged them into confessions on TV. And that has really tamed things. The internet is still very lively and interesting, but they really are spending a fortune on controlling and modulating it. And now they're proposing, every year now in China, they have an international internet symposium down in Wuzhen in the south of China. And China has now become the global advocate of internet sovereignty, i.e. we want an intranet in China that we can control, though we want to participate globally in the internet generally. And it's a chilling development. And they're doing pretty well at modulating and controlling the internet.
Jeremy, a puzzle. Of late, we've heard very little about Tibet. Is this because the media is off their game, or have things been successfully suppressed?
In the 2008, 2009, the media tried to find out what really happened in Lhasa with that, what I call the rebellion in Tibetan China, and the Chinese crushed a lot of the information gathering, let alone the actual rebellions. But since then, the Chinese authorities have instituted extremely harsh policies, and we just hear less about it because fewer people can go anywhere near there, and there's less information getting out and about. Now, there is talk that there's this constant talk. I've seen Tibetan friends recently about the possibility of the Dalai Lama and his government negotiating with the Chinese some sort of relationship, some sort of amelioration next year or the year after. There's great hope that after the next party congress, the 19th party congress next year in 2017, things will calm down. But meanwhile, after the Tibetan riots of 2008, the government of China has brought in more control into every major monastery and every major township in both Tibet and what used to be called Amdo, Qinghai province, as well as Tibet and Sichuan and Yunnan.
And finally, it's the year of the monkey for the Chinese. It's the year of the clowns for the United States. To what extent would Beijing be interested in what's happening in the presidential fluctuations?
There is extraordinary and vital interest. What is so amusing is that on the Democrat side, we see a possible socialist with a conscience, Bernie Sanders. What a horror that would be for China. Maybe more of a socialist in America than they have in Beijing in charge of the government. That would be the supreme irony. Or they have Hillary Clinton, someone who has been outspokenly critical of the Chinese government, outspokenly involved with human rights abuses in China and media freedom issues, and they really, really, really don't like Hillary. On the other side, they are delighted at the thought of the Republicans. Do you think the pack of lunatics who won't know how to deal with China? Because we will just outmaneuver all of those clowns, whether it's Rubio or Cruz or Trump. So the Chinese, I would be estimating, as they so often do, would be very much in favour of a Republican victory.
Jeremy, thanks. Thanks very much for coming back. Jeremy Barmey, founder of the Australian Centre on China in the World and research professor in the ANU's College of Asia and the Pacific. Good on you, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Phil.
And on tomorrow night's Little Wireless program, back to the Year of the Clowns in the United States as we look into the billionaires who are backing Ted Cruz. And one of my all-time favourite guests, Bill McKibben, rejoins us to discuss matters arising from the small problem of climate change. Stick around now for the news on RN. See you tomorrow.